thankful to Mark for leading and reading. And just as he read, I was struck by the fact that there's quite a few things in that passage that I'm not going to mention tonight. I can't deal with everything in it, but some of the things we'll come back to. We're going to concentrate on some things. So if you turn to the passage, 2 Samuel, chapters 4 and 5, and you'll see from the sheet that verse 9 is a sort of theme verse tonight. It says, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity. If you've got the New King James, you'll notice that the word as is in italics. So David literally is making a statement. The Lord lives. The Lord lives. That statement changes everything and shapes everything. It was a life-shaping truth for David and should be for us too. The Lord lives. If that's true, then everything changes. That should shape your life. That should shape my life. In Psalm 18, verse 46, David says the same words, writes the same words. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. Let the God of my salvation be exalted. So the fact that the Lord lives meant that David had a rock. He had a foundation. And he had a salvation. Let the God of my salvation be exalted. So it was a comfort for David. Whatever else happened, whatever other news was brought to him, whatever other changes there would be, the Lord lives. God's alive. The New Testament equivalent is this. Jesus has risen. Jesus is alive forevermore. That changes everything. And of course, when David says that, I mean, it's a contrast, isn't it? The Lord stands in such a contrast to everything else that's going on around David. So the previous chapters and this chapter is full of death, or full of news coming of death to David. So the last chapter of 1 Samuel, the first chapter of 2 Samuel, is the report of the death of Saul and Jonathan and the people of Israel, the men of Israel. The king is dead. And then in chapter 2, we have the death of Asahel by Abner. And then in chapter 3, we have the death of Abner by Joab. And people are dying all around David, but the Lord lives. The Lord lives. The chapter 4 begins, doesn't it, with news coming back to Ishbosheth that Abner has died. And look what we're told in verse 1 of chapter 4. When Ishbosheth, that's Saul's son, heard this, he lost heart. You see that? He lost heart. Literally, his hands dropped. All his strength went. He gave up. Why was that? Well, he'd been trusting in Abner, even though actually in the previous chapter we've seen, haven't we, that Abner had turned on him. But he'd been relying on Abner. He'd been trusting that Abner was his rock. And now Abner's dead. But while Ishbosheth is told that Abner is dead, David can say, the Lord lives. He's never going to hear the news, and the news is never going to be brought to him. The Lord is dead. God is dead. No. David knew that the Lord, the I Am, would always be the I Am. The Bible often refers to God as the living God, doesn't it? The living God, as opposed to the idols of the world, of the nations around that have eyes but they can't see, and ears but they can't hear, and feet but they can't walk, and tongues but they can't speak. And God is the living God in opposition to that. He speaks, he acts, he intervenes, he saves. And that's what we see in these two chapters. That's what I want to focus on in these two chapters. The Lord lives, the living God, and he's doing all sorts of things in these chapters. And so I want to see, you'll see there are five things. We see the living God redeeming and judging and providing and establishing and defeating. Okay, so let's think about each of those for a little while. First of all, we see the Lord lives, and he is redeeming. Okay, so go back to verse 9 again of chapter 4. As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity. So the word redeemed means what? It means to be to secure the deliverance of someone. It means to rescue them. It means to save them. And that's what David had known. He'd known the Lord redeeming him, saving him, rescuing him time and again. So the statement isn't saying, is it, that the Lord had saved David from knowing adversity. It's not saying that. It's not saying the Lord had given David a trouble-free life. It's saying when he was in adversity and when he knew trouble, the Lord brought him through. The Lord kept him in it. The Lord gave him grace to bear it. That's what it's saying, isn't it? The word adversity actually here is a really strong word. It means greatly distressed. And we've seen that, haven't we? We've gone through the life of David. There's times when we've seen him greatly distressed. There's times when we've seen him weep till he's got no more strength to weep. There's times when he's hiding in a cave and an army against him. He's had to flee for his life. He's faced adversity. So we're reminded, aren't we, that God's people do face such times. We do face adversity. We do face great distress and trouble. And when it comes, we're not to be surprised and we're not to doubt the Lord's love. But David could say, the Lord's rescued me and redeemed me and brought me through all that adversity. Here I am today. I'm here. And the Lord has helped me. And the Lord who lives has rescued me. He's able to declare that. Here's David, still alive, still saying, the Lord lives. The redeeming God. And of course, redemption, we know, is a key theme of the New Testament, isn't it? We're a redeemed people, if we're Christians here. Jesus is our Redeemer. There's great words, aren't there, in Ephesians 1, verse 7. In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins, according to the riches of his grace. You know, what was the cause of our greatest distress? Well, it was what we were thinking about this morning, our sin. Who's our greatest adversary? The one we were thinking about this morning, the devil. Jesus has defeated him. Jesus has dealt with our sin. He's redeemed us. He's delivered us. He's rescued us. Do you remember how Peter puts it in 1 Peter 1:18, you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without spot and without blemish. We're redeemed. God has redeemed us. The Lord lives, and he's a redeeming God, and he's rescued us, and he's delivered us, hasn't he? That we might live for him. If we're believers here tonight, we can say these words, can't we, with David? Who has redeemed my life from all adversity. Here I am tonight. And there have been troubles and trials and difficulties in all our lives, some more than others, some greater than others. But here we are tonight, and we can say the Lord lives. And he's redeemed us, and he's kept us, and he's delivered us. And we're here by his grace this evening. I mean, we're thinking this morning, weren't we, that one of the great antidotes to the devil's temptations is to remember our blessings, to remember how good God is to us, to say to one another, as the Lord lives, who's redeemed my life from all adversity and kept me. If you're not a Christian here tonight, what do you need? You need to be rescued. You need to be redeemed. You need to be rescued from your sin. And there's only one person who can do it, and it's Jesus. So we see the Lord, the living God redeeming. Then we see the living God judging. We see him doing that through David, his anointed king. We see his judgment coming on these two men who were captains of Ishbosheth's troops, Baana and Rechab. They walk, well, Mark read it to us, didn't he? They walk into Ishbosheth's in the middle of the day while he's asleep on his bed having a siesta. And they stab him to death. They take off his head and they escape with it and they head to David in Hebron. Clearly imagining that David's going to be pleased with them and will give them a reward. Well, they obviously haven't read earlier on in, have they, where, you know, remember the Amalekite comes to David claiming to have killed Saul, whether he had or not. Well, we had a bit of a debate about that afterwards, didn't we? But, well, they obviously hadn't heard about that. I mean, it was a despicable, cowardly act these two men have done. And they've done it under the pretense of getting wheat, and they've gone in and they've killed him. They've stabbed him in his sleep. And then worse still, they dress it up as if it's doing the Lord's work. Did you notice that? In verse 8, they say, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day of Saul and his descendants." I mean, they try and cover up their wickedness and greed under the guise of being doing the Lord's work. One of the commentators says they have blood on their hands and theology on their lips, and greed in their hearts. They're doing it. They want a reward, don't they? And yet instead they receive judgment, don't they? I don't know what you think about these two men. I mean, it's pretty gruesome, isn't it? They're hung up, aren't they? And when people were hung up in the having been executed, it was as a warning. It was as a sign. They're put to death. Look at verse 11. David says, "How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house, in his beds? Therefore, shall I not require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" So David is acting here on the Lord's behalf. He's doing what the Lord commanded. There's sort of biblical language there, isn't there, from earlier time. Shall I not require his blood at your hands? Remove you. So these men, hung up by the pool in Hebron, a reminder of the Lord's judgment. You see, in these chapters, they're full of killing, aren't they? They're full of death. I mean, it's pretty wild west, if you like, isn't it? And yet we're reminded that very easy in that situation for life to become cheap and justice to go out the window. But no. The Lord still cares about justice. Life isn't cheap in God's sight. And these two men hung up are a reminder of that. That judgment will come. Now, of course, the truth is that David himself is rather inconsistent with his judgment and justice, isn't he? Because Joab, in the previous chapter, the commander of the army who killed Abner, should have been put to death for what he'd done, but he's a bit too powerful, isn't he? And he's a bit too close to David. But we know, don't we, there's no such favoritism with God. The Bible tells us more than once he's no respecter of persons. You can't pull some card of this is my position, this is my power with God. No. So here's King David administering justice and sometimes doing it and sometimes not, but we've got David's greater son, King Jesus, and when he comes, he will administer justice. So Jesus is the Redeemer who saves those who come to him, but he's also the judge, isn't he, who will judge those who do not come. So we have God, the living God, redeeming. That's a wonderful thing, but also judging, and that is also a wonderful thing. It's a solemn thing, but it's a wonderful thing. It would be even more terrifying, wouldn't it, if God did not care about justice. And at the end of time, it's going to be a wonderful thing when God puts everything right. And we might get a bit funny about it here, and this kind of, but when if you live in somewhere like Nigeria or Zimbabwe, where there's very little justice and there's great wickedness, and many other places as well, the fact that God is a God of justice and will judge is a good and comforting thing. So we've got the living God redeeming, we've got the living God judging, we've got the living God providing as well. So chapter 5 begins, isn't it? And David is made king. And it's clear that David is the Lord's provision for Israel. Look at the second part of verse 2. "The Lord said to you, 'You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel.'" So the Lord is providing for his people. Do you see that? And he's providing a king who will shepherd them and rule them. Now, notice two things with me. You'll see it on the sheet. Notice the king's credentials and the king's calling. First of all, the king's credentials. What reasons do they give as they open the chapter for making him their king? Well, first of all, he's their flesh and bone, isn't he? Verse 1, "Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh." You know, you're one of us. We're one with you. We're the same. You know, he's not just one who's come to take over. He understands them. He knows them. He's one of them. And then secondly, they acknowledge, don't they, in the next verse, verse 2 of chapter 5, he's already fought for them. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led us out and led out Israel and brought us back. You're the one who went out to war and battle for us. He's already shown loyalty. In other words, he's already shown bravery. He's already done what a king should do. And thirdly, the third credential was this. The second part of verse 2, and the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel. He's the Lord's anointed. The Lord's a chosen here. Those are his credentials. You must be our king because you're one of us. And you've fought for us. And you've been chosen for us. And of course we can say all those things about Jesus, can't we? I mean, he's one of us, isn't he? He's the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. He knows us. He understands us. He's one of us. And he's fought for us. He's gone to the cross. He's fought for our greatest enemies for us. And he's been chosen for us. He's the Lord's anointed, isn't he? As well. He's the king. He's the king. And God has set him up. As we'll think in a moment. Is he your king tonight? Here you are in church. Is Jesus your king? Have you bowed to him and surrendered to him? There's the king's credentials. What about the king's calling? Well, it's there, isn't it, in verse second half of verse 2? You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over them. So he's to shepherd and he's to rule. That's what they needed. That's what the Lord has provided. The king was to be a shepherd. Now, of course, David knew all about that, didn't he? Because he'd been a shepherd. What does a shepherd do? Cares for the sheep, leads the sheep, feeds the sheep, protects the sheep, brings back the wanderers, refreshes the weary. To be a shepherd, you need to have a heart for the sheep and a love for the sheep and a willingness to give yourself for the sheep. Well, that's what God's provided this king, David, to be a shepherd. That's what his calling is. Not to lord over the sheep, but to be a shepherd. And that's what we need too, don't we? We need a shepherd. We need one to keep us and lead us and guide us because we're prone to wander and we're often foolish and we need a shepherd. And that's what we have in Jesus. He's a good shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep. But they also needed someone to rule over them. Someone they could follow, someone who would rule over them and be their king. They needed someone to keep them in order and give them commands. And we need that too, don't we? We need a king to rule over us. We need to be ready to submit and bow and say, Jesus is our king, and we'll show it by our obedience too. So the Lord who lives is providing for his people. He's providing a king. And of course, David was a great king, wasn't he? We admire him, but he falls short in so many ways. But God has provided for us a king, the King of Kings, and there's no fault in him whatsoever. He's without blemish altogether. So the Lord redeeming, and the Lord judging, and the Lord providing, and then fourthly, the Lord establishing. So the Lord establishes David as king, and he establishes Jerusalem as his capital city. So first of all, the Lord establishes David as king. We have to look at verse 12 of chapter 5, those lovely words. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. So it's very clear to David, he hasn't established himself. He hasn't made himself king. It's not that ultimately these people have made him king. It's not that anyone else has established him. It's the Lord who's done it. The Lord has made him king. The Lord has established him. The Lord has set him up as king. The Lord who's put everything in place and secured it all. I mean, think of all that's happened. And at times it seemed the most unlikely thing that's ever going to happen. As David's off in Gath in Philistine territory and he's pretending to be mad. And you think, that's the furthest away from ever being a king. And yet here we are in chapter 5. And the Lord has established him. I mean, in these chapters, again, there's various people trying to establish themselves, trying to gain power, and it all fails, doesn't it? And yet, here's David, and the Lord sets him up, and it will never fail. And it comes, doesn't it, from, look back to verse 10. It's a lovely verse as well of chapter 5. It comes back from the Lord being with David. So David went on and became great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. That's how he's established. That's how he became great. That's where his greatness came from. The Lord was with him. The Lord who lives, the Lord of hosts, the Lord Almighty, the sovereign Lord was with him, at his side, on his side. Again, to use the New Testament language, if God is for us, who can be against us? Who can be against us? So the Lord has established David as king. That's not the only way he's established him. David uses his language elsewhere. Just turn to Psalm 40. That wonderful psalm of David. How does it begin? Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the horrible pit, out of the miry clay. He set my feet upon a rock and established my steps. He put a new song in my mouth, praise to our God. Many will see it and fear and will trust in him. David's saying, this is the story of my life. I was in the pit. I was in the miry clay. And what's God done? He's taken me up and he's set my feet upon a rock. He's established my steps. He's secured my steps. I mean, that's our story as well, isn't it? The Lord's rescued us from the pit and the miry clay. And he set our feet. He's established our steps. Sometimes we have to wait patiently, as David says at the beginning of that psalm. Sometimes we have to pray, keep crying out, but he does hear and he will lift us up and he does hear our cry and he will establish our steps. If you made it to Psalms, you're on to Psalm 90, that psalm of Moses. As we serve the Lord, as we serve him here, what do we need to do? We need to pray something. We need to pray Psalm 90, verse 17. Let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. You know, if we do stuff in our own strength here, in our own lives or as a church, it will come to nothing. It won't accomplish anything. What do we need? We need the Lord to establish it. We need the Lord to be in it. And so whatever we do, we say, Lord, establish the work of our hands. That's what we were doing when we were praying a moment ago about Holiday Bible Club and whatever else it might be. We're saying, Lord, unless you do something, it's all in vain. The Lord establishing David as king. And of course, he's established ultimately Jesus as king. He's set up Jesus. The reason that you and I can be secure and established is because Jesus is secure and established. He's on the throne. He's in heaven. He's there, seated at God's right-hand side. All authority is given to him. And his throne is forever and ever and ever. And because he's established, because God has set his king on his holy hill of Zion, to use the Psalm 2, we can be established too. So David established David as king, and the Lord established David as king, and the Lord establishes Jerusalem, let's be back in our passage, as the capital city. So verses 6 to 8 tell us how David and his men enter the city of Jerusalem and defeat the Jebusites who live there and make Jerusalem, David's capital city, becomes, doesn't it, the city of David. And the Jebusites, of course, would be confident that they wouldn't be defeated. So they make that claim, don't they? Even the lame and the blind could defend the city. It's such a fortified city. It's such an impressive city that even if it was just the lame and the blind, well, they could defend it. Well, we're told this little bit about David's men being able to get through the water shaft and into the city, and the city's taken, isn't it? And so it becomes David's city. I just want to point out that this is a significant place, and these are a significant people. So first of all, the place, Jerusalem. Well, this is sort of the establishing of it as the capital, but things have happened there already, haven't they? We know from 2 Chronicles 3, 1, that Jerusalem was built on Mount Moriah. Well, where's the only other time Moriah is mentioned? Well, it's in Genesis 22, isn't it? Where Abraham is told to take Isaac, his son, and sacrifice him. And this is where he goes to, Moriah. But of course, he doesn't have to sacrifice him in the end, does he? Because God provides a ram in his place. But this is the place. And now it's King David's city. And one day, King David's greater son will come to this city and he will offer himself and he won't be spared. It's a significant place, isn't it? It's not by accident that this is established. And they're also a significant people, the Jebusites. These were some of the last remaining Canaanites in the land of Israel that had not been cast out. If you just turn back to Genesis 15, where God makes his covenant with Abraham 800 years or so earlier, Genesis 15, and verse 18 to 21, you get this list of who are going to get kicked out, who are they going to be delivered into their hands. The Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. And the Jebusites, they're the last on the list, if you like, that God is going to deal with so that his people can conquer the land. This is the fulfillment of a prophecy made 800 years earlier. So God's timing may not be our timing, but his word and promises can be trusted. 800 years later, after Abraham, you can still say, "The Lord lives." When all those generations that have come and gone, the Lord lives. His purposes are always fulfilled. The Lord establishes a king and a capital. Oh, we ought to perhaps sadly note verses 13 to 16 back in our passage again now. And remember that God's faithfulness is, in spite of David's failure, David in those verses from verse 13 to 16 continues to break God's pattern for life and marriage and home. He takes more concubines and more wives, and through them he has more children. And this is setting, I think this is setting David up for what comes when we get to Bathsheba. Because if you can have lots of wives, well, you can have another man's wife. And if you just begin to take women just to satisfy your own desires, well, you'll never be satisfied. And you'll see another one, and she'll look pretty and beautiful, and you'll want her too. And David's not only setting himself up for failure, he's setting his son up for failure as well, isn't he? Because he's setting an example here, isn't he? And Solomon. Wise King Solomon. The wisest man apart from Jesus to live, the Bible says. And yet it didn't stop him following his dad's example and having hundreds of wives and concubines who turned his heart from the Lord and brought spiritual disaster. I mean, it's just a reminder to us, if nothing else, that what example are we setting our children or the next generation? What are we putting in place? God is establishing, but David is sowing seeds of destruction. And we're thankful that we have a greater king than David. One last thing, defeating. The king defeating. So David is established on his throne in Jerusalem. Not everyone's happy about it. The Philistines definitely aren't happy about it, are they? And they're concerned this might break their hold on this area. I mean, a united Israel, they don't want that at all. And so they gather together and they come to put down this king, this upstart. And they don't just send a battalion or two, do they? Look what it says in verse 17. What did it say? When the Israelites heard that, all the Philistines went up for in search for David. So they're all, you know, there's various lords and various groups, but they're all united in this, aren't they? They don't want David on the throne. And yet, of course, David's dealt with the Philistines before, hasn't he? He's dealt with Goliath and others. And as before, he's not going out in his own strength, is he? He goes out to meet them, but he's aware as ever that the battle's the Lord's, and the Lord will go before him. And that's exactly what happens. And on both occasions, he inquires of the Lord, doesn't he, what he should do. Verse 19, So David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up against them? And the Lord answers him. Again, in verse 23, look. David inquired of the Lord. Now, there's a... I just want to point out a contrast, because back in chapter... Back in 1 Samuel, where David... Where Saul... Go back. Can you go back to 1 Samuel 28? Where is it? And verse 6. So this is a frightening verse. 1 Samuel 28, verse 6. The Philistines have come out against Saul now. Look at verse 6. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by the Urim or the prophets. I mean, that is a solemn thing, isn't it? That Saul has disobeyed God, and he's rejected God, and he's refused to listen to the word of God, and he's gone on in that, and he's sought David, the Lord's anointed, and he hasn't submitted to the Lord. And in his moment of crisis, he calls out to the Lord, and the Lord has nothing to say to him. I mean, that is a solemn thing. That if you're here tonight and you come here week after week, perhaps, and you refuse to listen to the Lord, well, that's a solemn. Don't keep doing that, because the Lord isn't mocked. Cry out to him, come to him, seek him, call on him to have mercy on you. Well, thankfully for David, even though David's a sinner and unworthy, yet the Lord, he inquires of the Lord, and twice the Lord answers him, doesn't he? In these verses, so he tells him what to do. So on the first occasion, they go up to battle at Baal Perazim, and the Lord goes before them, doesn't he? And we're told that they're swept away. So verse 20, look, the Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breakthrough of water. So you think of a big dam, and the dam bursts, and it sweeps down a valley, and it just sweeps everything away. And David's saying, that's what God was like when he went before us. He swept the Philistines away. And then the second time, look, David asks, and God says, don't go up, go behind them, but ambush them. Get that really fascinating verse, verse 24. And it shall be, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly, for the Lord will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines. Well, I think perhaps David has the sort of hearing equivalent of what Elisha's servant had when he saw the armies of the Lord. You remember that story when he saw the armies of the Lord encamped around the city? Does David have the sort of hearing version of that? He hears the Lord's armies, as it were, the armies of heaven. I mean, there's so much about the spiritual realm we don't know, isn't there? But God goes before him, and his enemies are defeated. This is God's doing. God is defeating. The Lord lives. And his enemies ultimately are defeated, and will ultimately be defeated. And in the end, Revelation 11, verse 5, there's a loud voice in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And he shall reign forever and ever. One day every other kingdom is going to be defeated, isn't it? And only one kingdom will stand, the kingdom of our God. So the Lord, the living God, redeeming, judging, providing, establishing, defeating. What a difference that makes. Jesus is risen, redeeming his people, defeating his enemies, establishing his kingdom, providing for his people, and one day coming again to judge the world in righteousness. We need to be ready. We need to be trusting. We need to be looking to the Lord.